Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of War Report. This is right after Christmas, and I don't know where people are, and I don't know how many people we're going to have on the show today. So we do have a full house, so we're going to get right to it. For those of you who maybe have not seen the promotion for this week, we're back in Detroit and some of the suburbs, the minority suburbs there that I sort of like grew up in. And we have hopefully people who will tell their stories so that the world could find out what is actually happening in the state of Michigan. I'm going to start with a guest who's been on the show. I think maybe this is the third time, Dr. Thomas Petroni. Tom, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much, Dr. Miller, for having me on.
Okay. Just a brief intro, please, and then we'll move on to the next person.
Sure. I'm an associate professor of curriculum studies in the College of Education at Wayne State, and I've been very involved in injecting some more truth and rigor into the educational conversation in Michigan around education and race and the power of the state.
Okay. I'm going to go to Kirk next because I heard, Kirk, you are just raring to go, so I don't want to hold you back any longer.
My name is Kirk Guyette, and I am an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Michigan, and I was hired a little over 2 years ago to investigate and write about issues involving Michigan's emergency manager law.
Cool. Okay. D. Richardson?
Yes, I'm D. Archers Richardson. I am presently a member of the Inkster City
Council. Can you speak a little louder, D?
Yes, I am presently a member of Inkster City Council. I also served on the Inkster School Board at one time for 4 years. Very active in my city. Retired.
Good.
From the state of Michigan.
All right. Lamar?
Yes, Lamar Lemons, member of the Detroit Board of Education, former immediate past president of the Detroit Board of Education, and a former state legislator from the state of Michigan.
Whoa, okay. And last but not least, Miss M. Denise Baldwin. Notice I got
I got that M
in there for you.
I heard it. I know. I keep people confused. I'm Melvin Denise Baldwin, and casually I go by Denise, but I'm a teacher in Saginaw, Michigan, and I have, just as a teacher, been aware of some of the disparate things that have happened with our students, particularly students of color and students of low income, and it kind of drove my passion out of the classroom into the community, and I have, broadened my perspective and began to work with some of the other advocates around the state in trying to restore public education in Michigan.
Okay. Wow. I am so glad to meet each of you. And if I can get back home, which we're trying to work out, I would love to meet each of you in person. I'd like to come to Saginaw. I'd like to come to Inkster for sure.
Absolutely.
Of course, start off in Detroit. You guys, last week and other shows that I've had, I've said that Detroit is a ground zero, and Michigan, and especially all of the formerly black, predominantly black, and maybe now black and brown suburban communities like Inkster, Ecorse, and et cetera, are also ground zero. Let me start with, I'm going to go to Inkster, because,
okay.
Dee, I just heard about what's going on there. Tell us what's happening in Inkster.
Huh. Well, Inkster...
Now, you're going to either have to speak louder or directly into the phone, because you're...
Okay, I am speaking. Can you hear me now?
Yes, very good.
Okay. Inkster is a community where our schools were completely dissolved 2 years ago. We had a deficit, like other communities. We are only 6.2 square miles, but within that radius, we had four different school districts, and we also had four or five charter schools in our city. Inkster, we were, like I said, in a deficit, and the decision was made by Lansing to dissolve our school district, Buena Vista, and also at the time, Pontiac was slated to be closed, but I think after L. Brooks Patterson got through with them, they removed Pontiac from that, so it was just the two of us, Inkster and Buena Vista. What happened with us is not only we had four schools that they gave money to, they dissolved our city into four sections, and our children were bused north, south, east, and west to other districts. Our schools were given to other districts, so we had no say-so over the school land or the building. Our possessions were sold, and our schools were demolished, every last one of them. Which has been very hard for us. I am a product of Inkster Public Schools. There's a lot of history here in Inkster, and it was very hard trying to obtain some of the artifacts from the school. Don Barton came from Inkster High School. The Marvelettes came from Inkster High School. I mean, there's just so many that I can name that are prominent citizens of the U.S. that came from Inkster High School, this little city. And I had to literally fight to even try to obtain the pictures, our trophies, just some of the things that we can have to remember that Inkster once did have public schools. So now we're in a situation where no one wants to move to Inkster. I mean, why would they? We have no schools. So, and then we're getting complaints from parents and from children that they're being mistreated in the other districts. You know, one girl got put out for rolling her eyes, you know. I mean, it's just so many horrific stories that no one wants to be bothered. They want the children's money, but they don't want to be bothered with the children and the issues that come with the children. So right now, Inkster, we did make a complaint through the NAACP. We haven't heard anything from that. We are right now doing a documentary where we're interviewing people, Inkster Listening Project, in conjunction with the Detroit Coalition, the Detroit Listening Project, to try to get our voices heard because we feel that it's an injustice to us. Period. But no one is really listening. And it's really devastating to go past where your buildings once were and there's nothing left. Even the bricks, just the things that I wanted, Risa, when I tried to obtain our history, some of the artifacts from them, Risa told me that I could buy them from the contractor. And I thought that was horrible. I just thought it was horrible. And on top of all of that, we have nothing. We still have to pay the debt that's left on the school district. So I think that this is really an injustice here in Inkster, and we're very upset about it. And we're just trying to get our voices heard. Detroit is going through a lot, and I'm glad that Detroit is fighting back and the other districts are fighting back. You have to fight back, and you have to let them know that what's going on now is completely unacceptable.
Dee, can I interrupt you? And
sure.
Let me just ask this question. The fact that they demolish your schools, cleared the land away,
yes.
is it possible that said move was motivated by being able to turn that land over or sell that land at a pennies on a dollar to developers who are either going to bring in industrial buildings or gentrification of the area? Very short, because then I'm going to go to other people.
Yes,
that a possibility?
I believe that, because I see that the transit, I saw pictures of where they're trying to run the transit going from Detroit to Ann Arbor, and then I saw a little spot, which is right at Inkster, that gives you a direct line to Metro Airport, and that would be right where Inkster High School was. So I believe there was a bigger plan in this than all the time. Even though that we had a deficit, my thing was, why didn't you send a financial manager in? That's what you do to other communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've been planning for a long time to do a show on the role of gentrification and the war on public education. People don't really connect the dots that gentrifying areas is a huge motivation for local, county, state governments to mm-hmm. seize the properties of public school sites for the purpose of turning them over to developers. That's a topic unto itself. We can do two shows on that. But let me now move to M. Denise Baldwin. Tell us about your area and what's happening.
Well, the one part of my story is very similar to D. Saginaw.
Where are you? Where are you again?
I'm in Saginaw, Michigan.
Okay.
In Saginaw, but Buena Vista Township is right, it borders Saginaw. It's actually where I graduated and grew up. And so our district, along with Inkster, was dissolved in 2013. You know, very similar scenario, except that our schools were not demolished, but they were given over to the surrounding district, one of which is Saginaw Public Schools, where I now work at Saginaw Public Schools, but they... just a year ago, were selling the building, and there were charter companies that were interested. One was involved with K-12 Incorporated, and they were interested in Buena Vista High School, as well as a local charter. A charter school was interested in one of the other buildings. But their interest was predicated on the closure of Saginaw High School, one of our high schools in the city of Saginaw, which was being proposed for closure based on its priority status with the state. And when it happened that the school board did not close Saginaw High, all of the interest in buying those Buena Vista buildings disappeared. And so we still have the buildings, but the contents were sold. Our the total library, the shelves, the books, all of the contents of our high school library were auctioned off for about $100. And so that's the type of devastation, besides the fact that the students were bussed out, and the teachers lost their jobs and had to start all over. In Saginaw, and so that's Buena Vista, but in Saginaw, we, as I mentioned, Saginaw High School was proposed for closure. And initially, our school had been threatened because of a deficit status. And so, you know, due to deficit elimination plans and all of that, there was the threat of state intervention. But just at the last minute last year, we found that the threat was because of priority school status, where the state of Michigan does a top-to-bottom list, and they name the bottom 5%. And that bottom 5% falls under the school state reform office, which is involved with the EAA and the 15 schools that they've taken over in Detroit. And so presently, I believe we have three schools in our district that are in that bottom 5% status, but one of the ones that seems to be on the state's radar is our high school, Saginaw High School. And so we still fall under or live under the threat of state intervention. It's quite confusing, as most of us know that reform office was taken from the Michigan Department of Education through executive order by Governor Snyder and placed in the Treasury Department or an office that closes to his hands. And so it has caused a lot of confusion, a lot of disenfranchisement in the community. And it feels like it's a moving target. You know, the school administrators and the officials don't quite know what it is they have to do in order to hold off this possible state intervention that hasn't even been clearly defined.
Okay. Let's go to Lamar.
Yes, sir. Okay.
And you are...
I am Lamar Lemons. I'm a member of the Detroit Board of Education and, of course, a former member of the Michigan State Legislature. And what we have here in the state overall and what you've heard is a two separate and unequal school systems being created. One where the which is predominantly black and brown, and the other which is white. In the black and brown districts, you don't have democratically elected governance. In the black and brown districts, you have one system of either emergency manager, the EAA, which is called the Educational Achievement Authority, which is the governor's private failing Jim Crow district, and you also have the charter system, where all the where the charter schools are not chartered by the local school district, but chartered by an authorizer, in most cases a state university where all the members are appointed by the governor, and therefore when the parent has their children in that system, they have no recourse but to take that child out of the system if they're dissatisfied, only to take it into another system that is also not locally governed, such as an emergency management system, as we have here in the city of Detroit. So it's two separate, and so you would say that 80% of all African Americans in the state of Michigan are in some form, under some form of governance that does not allow a democratically elected school board, and therefore the parents are disempowered and disenfranchised.
I'm going to be facetious here. Have you ever heard of Jim Crow?
Okay,
have you ever
of course,
heard of separate but unequal? I mean, no, separate but supposedly equal, Plessy versus Ferguson. Have you ever heard of all of this is by design, no accident? And when you look at, I think, maybe Tom, you put out a map, or Tracy, that showed all of the school districts that are being warred upon outside of Detroit, like 12 or 13 of them, are all black or brown. And I raised a question last week, could you guys name one single school in the UP, the Upper Peninsula, which when I was home, it was virtually all white, and whites left even my neighborhood when I was on the Far East Side. Many white families left there to move up to the Upper Peninsula because there were no black folks there. And so even I think when I was 15 years later, when I was at Wayne getting my PhD, I ran into one of my former neighbors, one of my best friends, and the first thing he said to me, you know, after hello, blah, 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 was that he was finally moving his mother up to the UP as soon as he got his master's degree in education, but you know how the neighborhood was. That was his exact quote. So my thing was, if you can't name a school in the UP, if you can't name a school in the white suburban areas across the Lower Peninsula, what does that tell, should be telling the entire world? And my statement last week was, we're talking about a class war, we're talking about a race war, we're talking about a gender war, because most of the teachers are female, and it's happening right there in my home state. I'm going to turn now to Tom, and then Kurt, since you guys, I think, have, as well as Lamar, you have that bigger picture perspective.
Here.
What, Kurt, what have you found, since you're now the investigative reporter who hopefully is devoting most of his time to what we've been talking about?
Well, I was writing about a lot about education a year or so ago, but really for much of this year, my focus has been on the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. And
well, I'm going to get to that a little later on in the show.
Okay. So I guess what's your question then?
Well, the bigger picture. Have you, in terms of your investigation...
Right. The bigger picture, my focus is on the interconnection between the state's emergency manager law and education. And it's been a failure. It's been a terrible failure, with Detroit being Exhibit A with the amount of debt that the state has driven the district into while it's been under state control. But it hasn't just been in the city of Detroit. The city of Highland Park has been another disaster. And what they did there was they kept the old school district and all the debt that had been created, because just as with Detroit, the city of Highland Park under emergency manager went even deeper into debt. And then they separated, they kept the old district and put the debt with that, and then created a new district that was run by a charter, a private charter school company that only served to drive children out of the district. So it's been a complete disaster there as well. And it is, the connection to Flint is that Flint was under emergency management, and decisions there led to the lead poisoning of children in Flint. That's going to create educational problems of, you know, for a generation of children. But that the person that was in Flint when they switched to the river, which caused the problem, that emergency manager is now the emergency manager over the children in Detroit. And so you get this situation that really is reaching levels of absurdity that are hard to convey.
So, James, I'm going to jump in here, too. This is Tom Pajoni from Wayne State University. And
let me just stop you for one moment, Tom. Tom, let me stop you for one moment. I was able to keep you silent for almost 20 minutes. That's a record. Oh, man. Folks, Tom is a buddy of mine. Tom's a buddy of mine. We're both profs. We're both the School of Education. We both are extremely upset with what's been going on, not only in Detroit and Michigan, but the rest of the country. And I can tease and play with him, and I just did it. One for me, nothing for you.
I'm going to be twice as angry now because you made me wait that long. I really appreciate it, James. I mean, this is an incredible group that we have together here to, I think, illustrate some of the points that you and I and others have talked about before and as recently as last week. So what I see, Kurt was beginning to speak to some of the things that unify these different cities together, and I want to help lay that out a little bit from my perspective as well, and maybe even connect that to what's happening in some other states. But let's think about Michigan first. What we have is a situation where, under the conditions of public austerity, state austerity, urban austerity, school district austerity, we have a variety of different impacts on African-American communities. But we need to go back historically a little bit to the housing crisis, foreclosure-led crisis, the foreclosure-led financial crisis beginning in 2006 through the global financial crisis in 2008. I think, to understand a lot of what we've seen in the educational realm and in the general municipal realm when it comes to the rights of Black and brown people, as well as the wealth, really, frankly, of Black people in various different cities. So if you think about the different examples that have just been laid out before us, educationally, first of all, the threat in Saginaw that was used to try to discipline the elected board there to sell some of its buildings that it really, the community didn't want to have it sell, was the threat of emergency management and the knowledge of what happens when an emergency manager is imposed. In Inkster, too, the idea was, well, there's a financial crisis, and it's the financial crisis that enables the state to come in and to usurp the democratic powers and the control of the local, mostly Black or brown constituency. Now, if you remember that when the downturn happened, the severe downturn happened in 2007, 2008, and a little bit going forward, those things were not generated. Those downturns were not generated Black and brown communities, right? I mean, those downturns were generated in the larger global financial structure. They were generated in the housing market in the U.S. and globally. And the already in that first round, the folks who were most victimized were black and brown folks in our cities, in places like Inkster and Saginaw and Flint and Detroit. But though, despite being victimized by that downturn, at the same time that the public was bailing out, you know, the whole too big to fail notion, the auto companies and many of our financial institutions as well, there was no similar bailout for urban communities of color. They instead were made to pay the savage price of what capitalism reaps, right? They are the ones who get punished with austerity, not capital itself. And so what we saw was not only a destruction of black wealth, which had accumulated marginally in places like Detroit, which was the center of black homeownership in cities in the United States, but you also saw the destruction of public wealth in the sense that public revenues decreased dramatically. And that decrease in public revenues in turn created the financial conditions that allowed for state takeover in the various different jurisdictions. So emergency management, which Kurt has been reporting on, is one and in some ways the most austere, the most totalitarian solution. But there are other pressures as well that need to be taken into account in the same breath that we're talking about state power intervention with emergency management. You also have the coercive power of a state that threatens to come in, whether it's Pontiac or Saginaw. And you have the state power to take other measures like the complete dissolution of districts and the effects of the people who have long struggled in those communities in places like Buena Vista and Inkster. And that, I'll be quiet here in a moment because you've been very generous, but I want to build another...
I know you won't be quiet. I know you won't be quiet. Go ahead.
Let's pause for a minute. But to help further build a bridge to Kurt's most recent work in Flint, Flint to me is, and the poisoning of children and communities with lead will have impact for generations now, it sort of helps us to tie it all together. Because what it allows us to see is what happens when you take away democratic accountability. There were so many times in Flint and in cities like Detroit, with its various corruption scandals, both in the EA and DPS, where the elected citizens and elected bodies could have had the capacity to address what was happening in some way that might have been preventative. And it was the undermining of that democratic accountability that catalyzed such destructive results for folks in communities like Flint and in Detroit. And I think that that's what we really need to talk about, is what enabled Americans to believe that it was okay if you were in a condition of financial crisis that was not generated within the community itself, to then take away that community's democratic rights. And this gets to your notion about the UP, because I think the only thing we can conclude is that, for the most part, white Americans will not tolerate the usurpation of democracy in white communities. Because democracy is supposed to be the solution to the problem, not the problem itself. But what you can see in this is certainly unconsciously, with a lot of folks, if not directly, is this notion that, well, if you take away that power from black communities, brown communities, that's okay, because in the white supremacist imaginary, those people don't really know how to govern themselves anyway. They do better under a white caretaker like the state of Michigan, embodied in the power of Governor Snyder. And so there's a willingness to accept that, you know, black communities really could use that sort of strong central governance. Now, the danger that white people should understand, even if they don't care at all about people of color, and I think many of them do, at least rhetorically, but is to understand the way that African-American or black and brown communities are a stepping stone to the very kind of dismantling that could happen in the public sector and more broadly in their own communities, and that there's a real threat there. And I'll stop there for a moment, but I think that that highlights some of the thing that I wanted to bring to the conversation.
Well, Tom, you hit on many, if not all, the points that I have made over... We'll be on the air 2 years this coming February. And on that two-year period, pretty much have made that case that you just mentioned in terms of white people not caring. I've talked about the fact that we, the black and brown communities, were the first to be warred upon. And once that war was moving along so successfully, then they brought in another weapon called austerity. Under austerity, even white folks started to lose their AP courses, which pissed them off for days. And then their humanities, their after-school program, that pissed them off even more. And then the coup de grace was a Common Core. When you brought in the Common Core and you made that connection with high-stakes testing, that's when you got Tea Parties, Tea Partiers, you got the Republicans, you got some of the corporate Democrats, you got a whole coalition popping up saying, hell no, oh hell no. Let me give you an example. I went to Maine. For those of you who are not familiar with me and the show, I just returned home here in Los Angeles from 8 weeks on the road. I went to 5 states, I don't know how many school districts. I interviewed and recorded those interviews, videotaped those interviews, over 50, 60 people. But in Maine, this, what I just said, just hit home in spades here. Maine has about 1 million people. I made 2 trips to Maine. The first one to Maine, I said this last week, I saw 3 black people. The second trip, I didn't see any. And in talking to the parents and the teachers and would-be politicians, et cetera, what pissed them off was, and this is what they're fighting in Maine, is they want to ensure their local school board control of education. They do not want the state, which they look at in terms of not only the state but the federal government, to come in and screw around with their local schools. That is their domain. They pay for it through their taxes. They have the elected school board. And how dare you to even blank, blank, blank think about coming in and blanking with our local schools. That was that, and then, of course, Common Core was the two issues that they were concerned about. I think, and I mentioned this last week, I think there was only one school in the entire state that they were aware of was like a turnaround school, but not taken over, not given to charters. And also, they have some very strict charter laws there. Charter schools have to adhere to the state ed laws, just like the public schools. Now, what I'm saying here is, you look at the, I think maybe Tom, it was you who sent it out, but look at Flint, Pontiac, Royal Oak, Detroit, Hamtramck, Highland Park, Wayne County, River Rouge, Ecorse, Lincoln Park, Allen Park, and Inkster, Benn Harbor, and Muskegon. Those are, when I was, and also for people who didn't know, someone didn't know who said something that on the Facebook today, why was this guy in California so concerned about what was happening in Detroit? And as I wrote back to him, if you listen to the show or if you went to the Facebook group, you'll know that I was born and raised in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Not only that, I went from kindergarten to my PhD, kindergarten to 12th grade. I graduated from Southeastern High. I got my PhD from where Tom is in sociology and sociology of education out of a graduate school of education. I have long-term historical roots there. just to amplify, Ecorse. I used to spend summers and Christmas in Ecorse because my mother's brother and my cousin were there. Highland Park. Highland Park was surrounded by Detroit. I used to party in Highland Park. Inkster, same thing. You name it, Hamtramck. Well, Hamtramck, when I was growing up, was Polish, and we couldn't go into Hamtramck and come out safely. Royal Oak. I used to go to Royal Oak all the time. I'm taking up a lot of time, but only to say that, to see that it's only the black and brown schools, both throughout the Lower Peninsula. How did this happen? It was not by accident. I will now turn it back over to, let's go back to Kurt again. Again, you have done, and then I'll go back to Lamar. You guys, you know, Lamar, you served in the legislature. You saw the big picture. Kurt, again, am I missing anything here? Is there any more that you can say so that the public will know how Michigan is being screwed over, both when you had a Democratic governor as well as a Republican regime?
Oh, boy, there's just so much to say on the subject that, you know, how much this is just reflective of an overall attack on public education by people who want to see it privatized, and that by privatizing public education, they, you know, weaken teachers' unions, you know, which affects the democratic process. You know, it's just such a involved subject. There's just so much that you can see, but that Detroit is the example of what happens when all these different things, when you take away democracy from elected school boards, when you privatize and put things like the Education Achievement Authority in the hands of an appointed board rather than an elected board, and you end up using kids as guinea pigs to test product for private corporations. You know, it's just horrendous on so many levels. No, I'll leave it at that.
Lamar?
Well, ultimately, it appears to us that our children are becoming not only experimental guinea pigs, but fodder the prison industrial complex. That is, that in over the schools, not only have we been disenfranchised, but they are failing abysmally. And in their failure, the children are not acquiring the skills necessary to build a sustainable life, and they result in end up being in somehow caught up in the correction system, which is another part of the private prison industrial complex, which the charter, many of the same charter investors are invested in the private prison industry, and so they are guaranteeing that they have some product in the person of our children. So we are outraged.
Okay. Denise?
I'm sorry. Yes, here I am.
You have anything you want to add?
No, there's been so much that's been said, and it all, you know, fits in and makes sense. And I really like the way Tom brought out the fact that the threat of emergency management was used to force certain actions, you know, especially within Saginaw, we saw that. It was always the catalyst behind the decisions. They were being made by our local school board. So there was an appearance of local control, but they were being made under the threat of this looming emergency management state intervention, you know, monster that hangs over the state. And as you say, it doesn't hang over the entire state, but only the communities of color.
Okay.
Yes, I just wanted to add that...
Louder, please.
Yes, I wanted to add that Inkster at one time had a financial manager that was sent in, emergency manager sent in by the state, but he left out with still a $600,000 deficit, and after doing an audit, they found out that he had overpaid himself. In saying that, when we got control back from this financial person, we were mandated by the state to improve every school that we had. So when he left out the $600,000 deficit, and since we had to go in and fix up every last one of our schools, our deficit rose up to $6 million. And that was mandated by the state. You either fix up these schools or else you close. So we were forced to, the citizen passed bonds, we fixed up the schools, and then you come in and then you say, hey, you're in a deficit, we're going to take the schools. We didn't have an opportunity. There were other investors that tried to buy the high schools, but since they gave the schools away, like Romulus was in charge of Inkster High School, there were several investors that tried to buy Inkster High School before it closed. We had just put $600,000 in that pool there that they destroyed, you know, and so Romulus said, no, we're not selling. But then you turn around and the state gives them $5 million to destroy our schools. So, you know, it's just a bad situation all the way around. It really is. And you can really just see now, like the other, former legislator was saying, our children now, where if there is an issue in the school, so instead of with, you know, back in our day, if a child was disruptive, you got sent to the principal's office, you know, but now what they're doing is they're calling the police, disorderly conduct. So that is totally unfair. So there is a movement going on, and I think it's up to us to change those things. We elect people, and people have to become more aware, and we have to be very mindful and very careful of the people that we put into these positions, because what they're doing is they're turning on us, and our families and our children are being destroyed, and everything is now is just about money. So I just wanted to add that piece.
Well, and I thank you, because that's exactly where I was going to pivot to. Let's talk about the resistance. Now, Tracy's not on the show. I know she's listening, and I know she's heavily involved with several resistance groups there, and I would put it to everyone this way. We've just heard about the state of public education in the Detroit and surrounding communities of color, the state of those communities in the wake of war. What is the fate of those school districts also in the wake of war? And by that, I specifically say, let's talk about the resistance. If Tracy was here, I think she would talk about truth. And I know that's an organization that she's very, very much involved in. But for the rest of you, what's happening on the resistance front? Do we have anything going, and can it be successful?
Well, this is Lamar. Let me say this. We are resisting. In fact, we refer to ourselves as the Detroit Board in Exile. Although we are duly elected, we are without elected power. Governance, the power to govern. However, we have, and of course, with any strategy, most of it has to remain clandestine until it is needed. So I'm not at liberty to discuss, but I can rest assured we are resisting, and we are taking a series of strategies to mobilize and educate the general population.
Okay. D?
Yes. What we're doing is we have joined forces with members of the Detroit community, Detroit Coalition, Journey for Justice, and they have what we're doing is we are documenting and filming a video of how parents and how students in the communities are feeling, how we are devastated by what's going on. Our thing is that when our schools closed, we made a complaint through the Justice Department. They said there was no injustice done. But we're saying that education is a human right, and we have a right to educate our own children. But so that movement we're starting, we're going to have, we had our first couple of sessions, and we're bringing people in the community to talk about, too, because really, it is really devastating for us, because we feel like someone has died. I mean, it's like you lost a family member, you know, because Inkster Public Schools, I've been in Inkster all my life, and you know, my children went there, my brothers and sisters, and it's just so much. You know, we were really a neighborhood, a loving neighborhood. But what we're doing now is we're trying to get our voice heard to let people know that there is an injustice done. The point of us doing the listening project is to get that to the UN. We want them to look and see that there is an injustice done to them by destroying our educational system. And even not even the educational system, we don't even have control of the land that they took from us, that we're but yet we still have to pay the bond on the land. With all the bond issues and everything we passed fixing up the schools, we're still stuck with that debt. That is on our head. So to me, that is an injustice. And our children are suffering because they felt like they're out of place in the other communities. They're not wanted, especially when, you know, they're used to maybe going to a principal's office if there was an issue, whatever, and you're calling in the police now. So you are starting.
Okay. Let me go. I got to you, Denise. I've gotten to Lamar. Now, D.
Yes.
Tom, I'm going to put a muzzle on you. Give me 1 minute, and then I'm going to get to Kurt. Then I have a few things that I want to say. So go, Tom.
Well, I only got 1 minute. Okay. Well, I was actually going to encourage you to talk to Kurt, but actually. I'll just be real quick. I mean, Dee laid out, I think, so much of the important framework that we're looking at right now, which is there's the Detroit Life Coalition, which along with Keep the Vote, No Takeover in Detroit, are the local affiliates of Journey for Justice, which is a nationwide movement coming out of black and brown communities, led by G2 Brown, the lead hunger striker defending Diet High School this past summer in Chicago. And the really exciting thing about that is it's giving us the incentive and the imagination to put up resistance in interesting ways. So one of the things that we are talking about doing right now, in addition to the Listening Project, and we hope the Listening Project, one of the next stops will be Saginaw, and we'll probably go to Flint as well, is also to organize a conference. And we're aiming right now for this summer, July, to bring together all of the majority-minority school districts across the state to recognize the particular ways in which they are targeted by this combination of austerity politics, white governance, and white supremacy as an ideology to dispossess black and brown communities of their schools and their communities more generally. We want to bring those boards together of the majority and minority districts to do some strategizing and organizing together to realize it's not just Detroit, it's not just the major cities across the U.S., but it's happening in these smaller communities, and they're an important part of this archipelago that's a part of the larger archipelago, however you say that, part of the larger puzzle. Ooh, I think I used up my minute.
Oh, yeah, a long time ago. Kurt.
Well, a couple of things. One is, before I get to the resistance part, I just want to point out just how big a part poverty plays in all this. I mean, in some ways, the poverty along with racism is at the root of this. And, you know, we have cities like Detroit where people are getting their water shut off and kids are going to school dirty and teachers are afraid to say anything because if they report it, the child gets taken by Child Protective Services. And so there's that fundamental issue. In terms of resistance, from my perspective, reporting the truth is a form of resistance. We saw it in Flint that we were relentless in trying to get the truth out about water to the point where we participated in independent tests. And eventually we were able to force them to return to a cleaner source of water. And so, you know, finding allies to work with, and even like what they're talking about in Inkster with the Listening Project and bypassing the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is never going to leave. They're only going to play catch-up on this. And so you have to sort of build the groundswell, and there's lots of avenues out there to do it. And telling the truth of stories of, like, Inkster, which is really just unbelievable, is another form of resistance.
Okay. I just been handed a Christmas present from the network. It seems that because we had Tom on the show, and I know that he was going to always go over the minutes allotted to him, that they've given me more minutes. We can go beyond the time pen, 3 o'clock my time, 6 o'clock your time. So, Tom, you brought a Christmas present. We can have as much time as we want going in after 6 o'clock your time and 3 o'clock my time. See, Tom, you haven't been here for a long time. I get a chance to really mess with you, man. Okay, let me add a few things, and then we're going to continue this. One, for everyone who's on the panel today, I encourage you to go back and look at the 5 shows that I think I did just before I took off on my research project, my documentation project. And those 5 shows dealt with what I call the neoliberal driven war on public education. If you go back there, what I think you will get from any one of those or all 5 of those shows is a much bigger picture of what is happening to public education, what I've been calling the war on public education, the motivation, the who, the why, the when, the where, and the people who are involved. And if you do that and really pay attention to what covered there, I think you'll come away with a much better understanding, not only of what's happening on the ground in your community and the community next door and what's happening in Detroit and Michigan, but how all of what you guys are experiencing have been taking place all across the country, but not just the U.S., but Europe, Asia, and Africa like hell, and Latin America for decades before we started to get the real brunt of what we now call the war on public education. That's one thing. And I was also going to point to Flint. Looking at what has happened to Flint, and this past week, that was a big, big topic all across Facebook, the Internet, what have you. Flint. Folks, Flint was predictable. Just like Detroit and the water situation there. All of this was predictable if you understand what I just alluded to, the neoliberalism agenda to privatize not just public education, but all of the former social net institutions like the post office, like Medicare, like God. The parks in those states where they're now turning our highways over to private organizations to set up toll roads, you name it. And here in California is one city that even turned over its entire government to a private entity to serve as mayor, city council, and I even think part of the judicial system. Privatization is what you guys have in common in terms of an experience. Also being black and brown, that is a predicate for all of this, of course. But it's the privatization of what I call everything and everyone. Michigan is truly a ground zero for the privatization that has been taking place over the last 30 to 35 years. So now that we have more time, I'll go back to each of us to add either more perspective. And also, I really wanted to hear from some of the other school districts, you know, like Port Huron, what's happening there? Highland Park, what's happening there? Can anyone speak on what's happening to some of the other school districts so that the audience who is hanging in with us will come away with a real solid understanding of how Detroit and the minority communities around Detroit are being screwed over by the powers that be. Can anyone address any?
This is Lamar. I will give a brief recap. We talked about Buena Vista, Inkster, Highland Park, Benton Harbor, Muskegon Heights, Pontiac on the cusp. And the only reason they did not destroy Pontiac, totally take over Pontiac schools, is because the Oakland County school districts of Bloomfield Hills and Rochester did not want to be inundated with a deluge of black and brown students, predominantly black students, into their district after they have successfully fought to isolate them. And someone referenced L. Brooks Patterson in the 1970s, fought to make sure that there was no busing and integration of those schools. So rather than destroy due to those school districts, what they did to Inkster, what they did to Muskegon Heights, what they did to Benton Harbor, and they decided to put them under a emergency manager light called a, and they have an agreement with them, and so they're under a supervision, but even though they are essentially, they were insolvent. So all those school districts, and then other places, they have been oversaturated with these privatized charters that, again, that I mentioned earlier, do not have democratic governance. So 80% of all African Americans in the state of Michigan are under some form of governance where they that is not democratic, and they cannot effectuate any type of change in those institutions. They only have the option to move somewhere else if they can afford to do so.
Can I inject the word dictatorship?
Yeah, that is very much what we have. The emergency
overseers from you remember dictators. Overseers from the slavery period. When we had overseers,
that's what the emergency manager is, and the dictator is the governor. Remember that the governor has very little authority, direct authority over education.
Constitutionally,
in over education in this state. Those powers are reserved to the state board and the superintendent of instruction. So what you have is a de facto coup d'état of what. Of the authority in the African American districts. They have made the districts, the African Americans, the Detroit Public School District, so undesirable, and the morale has been destroyed that they're creating educational refugees flooding the surrounding area school district. And those school districts are allowing those students to come in because they have so few students of their own.
You know, I'm going to go one step further. By now, you know, Tom is a friend of mine. So by now, hopefully, I haven't turned you guys off so I can really go to where I go on my show here. None of what is happening there, as I said earlier, is an accident. This was planned. This was, if you listen to the show, especially in the intro, the words Machiavellian agenda, and those five shows that I did on neoliberal-driven war on public education, where I talk about the Machiavellian agenda, this war was beautifully, and I use that word because that's what it was to me, planned and beautifully executed to put us where we are right now on the brink of destroying public education nationally, not just in black and brown communities now, but they took their shot at the white middle-class communities, and et cetera, and for the purpose of erecting a privatized, universal privatized system here in this country, like they did in Chile at one point, and various states that are privatized, like New Orleans, and not states, cities like New Orleans, like Detroit is moving to be, like Emmanuel is moving to do in Chicago, and you can identify more and more places. What took us so damn long to wake up to this and start trying to fight back? Even Tom is silent.
Well, I'm willing to speak. I just know every time I step forward, I get hatcheted. So, but I will say something. I'm a professor, so I've got to fill the space, right? So I want to say this. I want to say we have to think of this not just as a war on communities of color and a war on public education all the things that you've delineated, but we need to think about how this is fundamentally about a transfer of the idea of, or a change, a transition, the idea of citizenship away from something where there was a basic understanding of a social contract between people and their duly elected government. And we know that that was never a promise that was fully kept, but it was at least rhetorically something that we believed in as a nation. So that when we had, for example, you know, you can talk about the various different public sectors. So you want to talk about the educational sector. We know that public schools in low-income communities, especially African-American and Latino low-income communities, were never what they should have been, were never what they needed to be. But at least it made sense to step forward as a person within those communities and say, I don't care if I'm poor. I don't care if, you know, if I'm black or brown. I deserve to have, because I'm a citizen, I deserve to have the same quality education as you do somewhere else. That argument made sense, even though it was a vision that was never fully granted. But we're moving so far away from that. We're moving towards something, and I think that this is really where Flint is such an important case. I remember being horrified, and I imagine most people on this phone call were too, when we saw what happened in New Orleans before the schools, just during Katrina itself, where we had African-American people mostly on roofs waiting to be rescued, and the rescue never came. And I think that we were supposed to learn something fundamental there about a different notion of citizenship. I mean, the whole world was shocked, right? They were shocked to learn about poverty in New Orleans, which contradicted what they were learning about the U.S. for through, you know, television shows like Dynasty and so on. But then also just this notion that you wouldn't rescue your own citizens, or you would, but it would sort of be based on their skin color, right? Who gets rescued and who doesn't. I think there's a real, the greatest danger from Flint is not just the damage that is already happening in terms of the lead poisoning, but the greatest danger is that there'll be some fundamental acceptance in the American general populace that what happened there is just, that's just what happens under these conditions of austerity. And what it'll be is it'll be a further triumph in the ability of the state to cause massive damage to a group of people through, at best, negligence. But actually, I think a lot of the work that Kurt is uncovering is it's even, almost even more than negligence, where it wasn't just a failure to notice, but it was actually that people did notice and didn't do anything. So maybe a higher level of negligence, a much more almost intentional kind of negligence. That will be tolerated, I think, reflects a growing sloughing off of this notion of citizenship, of this basic idea that if you're an American, at least rhetorically, you deserve some basic level of provision of education or some basic general level of welfare. We used to believe that the state had an obligation to mediate the boom and bust cycle of the economy, right? We used to talk about this notion of full employment. That notion has almost totally disappeared now, and I think it's a gradual move away to what you're identifying more as a neoliberal state rather than the very limited version of a welfare state that we had in the U.S., where there was some basic understanding that was the obligation of the country, that you could hold people accountable for some of the poor conditions that you were experiencing in your life, because we understood that government decisions had something to do, whether it was in the economy or whatever, with what you were experiencing in your own community. And we're leaving that behind now, and I think what we're doing in a way is we're, as a country, sloughing off part of the population is really mattering. Right. And, you know, because the welfare state, that sort of general agreement between the populace and the government was necessary to keep capitalism intact after the crises of, you know, the Great Depression and so on. That's where you had the birth of the welfare state. But you don't really need.
Precisely, Tom. Precisely. It was during the Roosevelt years that, you know, this whole notion of the social welfare state comes about. It was also a reaction, a pushback during the 1930s into 40s that gave rise to the neoliberal ideology that we're currently being oppressed under globally. Yeah. And so that, again, if you go back and listen to any of those five shows, I talk about what you just said in terms of a remaking of America, a remaking of citizenship. They go even further in terms of the remaking of the human as a human being, a remaking of all of our social relationships, our relationship to each other, our relationship to the planet. This is all, and I'm not being a conspiracy theory, this is there, is documented, and back to Flint and back to Detroit as it relates to water. It has always been part of the ideology of the neoliberal ideologues to not only control through privatization humanity, but also the planet and all of its resources. So going in and taking control of the water system and saying that you're doing it for economic reasons to save money, I think it was $5 million something, and look at the harm that you've done to a generation of people and children. This is no accident, people. Not at all. Back to you, either Lamar or Dee or Denise. Can't hear you.
Okay. Well, I'm kind of I'm in agreement with everything that's already been discussed. I don't know what else I can basically add without being repeating everything that's already said. So, you guys kind of got it out there. That's very good. Very good.
Okay. Denise?
I would just like to, you know, add as we talk about resistance, that educating is just a tremendous necessary step in the resistance. There are so many people who are confused. A lot of the tactics that have been used in Michigan by the governor and his, you know, people are purposely confusing. You know, right now there are a number of plans floating around concerning Detroit public schools, and they're just similar enough, or the differences are just subtle enough that it's hard to pick it apart, and it's causing divisiveness and, you know, those types of things. And so educating the communities, the public, and even educating our elected officials is a very important aspect of our resistance. As Tracy, who was on your show last week, shared about the organization True, I'm also a member of True, and it's one of the primary strategies that we use, is bringing these things and these, you know, bringing some clarification to what has become purposely confusing.
What I call bringing awareness. I have a paradigm for the show when I first started the show, and that is awareness, trying to bring awareness where none existed or where it was tainted awareness. And my goal was to create awareness, but then to deepen one's awareness to the level of critical awareness. And from there, set the stage for understanding and the various levels of understanding to get to critical understanding. With my belief that with both critical awareness and critical understanding, will set the stage for the most important part of my paradigm, critical emotional engagement.
Yes.
When people become aware of what's going on and how and why, and they start to understand it, I'm hoping that they're going to get pissed off. And when people get pissed off, that they will take action, which brings me to the fourth step in my paradigm, that those three, critical awareness, critical understanding, critical emotional engagement, would lead to individually or collective critical social action or social justice movement. And that's what this show has been about from day one. And I even said last week that the one thing that last week's show was hopefully will do for everyone, is to get your stories out so that people become aware of what's happening in Detroit. I study it because that's home. I stay up to date with it. But the rest of the country, the rest of the world, as you mentioned, Tom, they need to know that education as a democratic institution is being crapped on deliberately for the purpose of destroying it. And I'm hoping that this show, like last week's show, will further enhance the public's awareness of what's happening in Detroit, and also that what's happening in Detroit is the model of what's been happening across the country and will continue to happen if the resistance doesn't get its act together and become a force to challenge what's going on.
Very true.
Now, back to, again, Kurt, or you, or and Tom.
Well, Kurt had to sign off. He had another obligation. And I think that, James, we'll have to strategize another show in the near future. I know also I have obligations that I need to meet with right now with my own family, and I imagine the others do as well.
Yeah.
But I think that you've laid the terrain for very valuable future conversations where, if you'd like, we can bring in people from other communities. Either that, you have to get them on the five phone lines.
I would love nothing more than to bring in, say, people from the other districts. And I would do another show if we can organize it. Okay. And maybe you guys also don't know, when I said I've been out on the road for 8 weeks, what I'm doing is I'm going to those states and those school districts in the states that I've visited. I'm talking to teachers, I'm talking to parents, I'm talking to students, college students, high school students, university professors, classroom teachers. I talk to legislatures at the board level, Board of Education, some of who are in elected legislatures, et cetera. And I'm doing this, I'm calling this the people's story, because as Kurt mentioned earlier, the mainstream public, I mean, mainstream media will never, ever, my double negative, cover our side of the war. Every war has casualties, and I've been out trying to talk to all the casualties that I could talk to so that they could tell the world about the human cost of this war. And like you guys have mentioned, having to be bused, getting up at 5 o'clock to be bused to another school because your neighborhood school has just been closed down. You mentioned the teachers losing their jobs and have to start all over again. Family relationships being strained. Relationship between teacher and students being frayed because teachers are now teaching to the test and not teaching to the student. And on and on and on. And I've documented almost 60 interviews that I hope to share with my academic colleagues, as well as trying to get all of this into form of one-hour episodes to describe what's happening in the various states that I visited. Detroit would have a two-hour project, as far as I'm concerned. And with that, recognize that you people have to go, and you've given up so much of your time already. I will say thank you, and we'll bring this episode about what's happening in Detroit and the rest of Michigan to an end.
Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
All right, thank you,
Brad. Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.